All right, so you calm down.
Yeah, well, I've got to tell you this, Bob, that there's one of your gambits, one of your familiar lines. I mean, I'm not annoyed with it because it comes round again, because I like people to come round again with what they say, because that proves that there's some consistency with what they say. So I'm not annoyed with you for coming round to this argument again, but I want you to, maybe you could unpack it for me, or maybe you'll close it up again when I explain to you why I feel a little unhappy with it. And what it is it's usually you using McLuhan. So you're quoting Marshall McLuhan, or you're using one of his ideas. And it's the idea that when an artist is really doing something important, he's understood that the medium is the message. So he's not using the medium as a kind of frame for what he wants to say. He's really seizing the opportunities of some new way of relating to other people, some new system, and using it to its full extent. And one of the phrases you use in talking about that is it has no content. One of the things that you say about Finnegan's Wake, which is for both of us, and we share this, we share two things really. We share James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake and the oeuvre of Frank Zappa, and we both think that these things are doing what you should do in terms of art. And one of the things that you say about Finnegan's Wake is that it has no content, that it's working on the materiality of what words and letters can do on a page, and therefore it doesn't have anything it wants to say. Now, I have real problems with this because it gets close to John Cage, and I want you to explain to me what the difference is between Finnegan's Wake and Frank Zappa and John Cage, because John Cage has become almost an orthodoxy within various areas of academia and people being trained in the arts, that John Cage is fantastic. And John Cage famously says, I am saying nothing, and this saying nothing is poetry. And that seems quite close to celebrating the idea of something having no content. And my worry is that in saying that something has no content, we're still stuck in the form-content opposition. Then we plumped for one side, form, and we're dissing the other side. And a really dialectical point of view would try and get beyond these frozen oppositions. In a sense that, you see, I think, and that people will misunderstand you, because it will sound like Finnegan's Wake is nihilistic or has nothing to say, whereas I think it actually has everything to say. And the way I put it is, I believe in an emergent content that doesn't come from fixing the frame, fixing the medium and keeping that static, and then communicating something, which I agree produces something very dull. But the artists who deal with the frame and deal with everything emerge with something to say which is overriding and very important. And some people's word for that might be content. And I don't want to kind of alienate those people straight away.
Okay, that's a great opening. It sums up all the objections I've had to deal with for 30 years, you know, being a public commentator. And there's a lot to unpack there. And to begin, the idea that great art is the artist doing the form, commenting on the form, or aware of the medium that they're making art in, is not exactly what I mean. Though I totally understand the way I say things in my little headline-ese or sloganeering, and which I'm forced to do in talk show format, that everything I say I personally don't agree with, because I don't get to qualify what I say. So I'm just known for headlines, or for saying Finnegan's Wake has no content. but Finnegan's Wake obviously has content. But when I'm around Finnegan's and they're analyzing the content, like we witnessed at that college in London, and they're lost in the rabbit hole of the content, I have to remind them that you can't make one head out of this is an ultimate summary of what Finnegan's Wake is about. So I'll just yell out, there is no ultimate content.
Okay, well, I'd like to gloss that for anyone listening, that the particular, we went to a seminar at Senate House in London, a university building with the Central University Library when the different colleges of London joined together to be a university. It was where George Orwell worked, and he based his idea of the Ministry of Fear on this building. And it has many little rooms where people meet together and do intense academic discussions about things. So we went along to see one on Finnegan's Wake. And there we were shocked and horrified to discover that they want to turn it all into a explain away the shock of reading Finnegan's Wake as, well, it's all actually a novel with characters. And now, I'm absolutely with you in insisting to those people that it does not have content in that sense, in the sense that you can reduce it to a novel with characters and a plot and this is happening here and now and this is happening then, because it flies in the face of the experience of reading any sentence of it. It just seems completely crazy to me. And anybody who, and so often people who come from outside an academic discussion of something and state the obvious actually hit the nail on the head. And I think you'd have to say Finnegan's Wake is not a novel in that sense. But the danger of you saying, of using the idea of without content is, I mean, for me, it's a similar mistake to saying in the revolution, we'll get rid of the bourgeoisie and we'll have the working class. The working class will be in power, which is the kind of Stalinist way of thinking about revolution. And it doesn't understand that once you break the power of capital, you no longer have a bourgeoisie and working class. So it's not a matter of having two sides and eliminating one side, then you've got the good side. That it's in eliminating the opposition, you move to something else, something new. And what I think Finnegan's Wake does is that by taking seriously all the sounds likes of phrases when you express yourself, it gets to an animal expression of who you are, which is outside the structures of any particular language. It gets to some direct, rhythmic, gestural, expressive utterance that you can make. It makes you like a cow mooing or a squirrel squeaking. It's trying to get to that because it finds that truer than any of the achievements based on dancing around with the little codes called national languages that exist. Now, the content of that for me is huge. It's amazing. It's more than some little message sort of said in code. It's a huge argument about what we are and what our species being is and how we could relate to nature and why are we alienated from nature. You know, there's a huge matter in that. And sometimes when you say it has no content, it's sort of like saying, well, Joyce didn't really want to do anything with this. He was a nihilist. And, you know, and that's where I feel worried by that formulation of yours, because you're not putting enough work in to explain why you like it or why you think it's important. Yeah, and then maybe it's a lack of work on your part there that I'm objecting to.
Perfect words, Ben. Perfect words. The last 5 minutes.
Well,
perfect.
No, that's the other thing I want to criticize you for, Bob, is this kind of, I try and say something to you very directly, and I get this little donnish kind of good point, you know, there in the seminar, which is always a strategy used by a don to actually deflect you. It flatters you a bit, and then once you've been flattered, then you suddenly realize that he didn't reply to what you said or admit that they'd been wrong. He kind of gave you 8 out of 10, but he's the person doing the marking, you know? And so I've got to break down this donnish technique of yours, Bob, in these discussions. So that's one of the things I want to do.
Okay, well, it does require you giving me a little time.
Okay. And also, yeah. I do expect you to be the Don, because I expect you to be the person that comes back with something coherent, because I realise that in the dialectic between us, I allow myself to go, and you allow me to go completely AWOL with what I'm saying. And I always expect you to pick up the pieces and organise it. So in a way, you know, in a seminar, I mean, you are a little bit older than me, maybe much older than me. Yeah. And so I sort of accept that relation. I realise I'm sort of locked in a student Don seminar, that I allow you this coherence, but you've got to listen to my specific criticisms and respond to them rather than patting me on the head all the time.
I need a ticker tape. You ever seen the Bloomberg ticker tape where you're looking at a talking head, but underneath there's all this other data flowing along underneath on the TV screen?
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, well, puns?
See, let me continue. Okay, yeah. You've heard of it. So I would like to type in responses to the many paragraphs you've said so far. And it's often daunting to remember everything. But I will take time. I'm going to begin.
I was thinking about this today on my radio show, about how radio can't have footnotes, because everything is squashed into the same crease of present time. We have no footnotes. A footnote is an interruption, not a footnote.
Right. It's a deficiency of the medium in terms of we're being didactic. We're trying to explain ourselves, which is really what one shouldn't do on radio. You just stimulate. You just do blips and blaps. Which is what your show does. You have Iris interrupting. You have music. You got your ramblings, and you have your tapings of.
But this is what we are doing. Is that if anybody's bothering to listen to it, it's because they quite like having this stuff trickling on, and they're not actually taking notes or, expecting a footnote here or, you know, that. If anybody is listening to this, they'll be listening to it because these two loons intensely arguing on. It's kind of a nice ripple to have, you know, like one of those little gardens that people have out of plastic with the water flowing endlessly around a wheel, you know, so that's pleasant for them. You know, that's what we're supplying, isn't it?
Yes, now the echo came in.
Oh, dear. Well, this echo has been haunting us, ladies and gentlemen, and it's an echo that Bob hears, but I can't hear, and it comes and goes, yeah. And it's been...
I'll try to ignore it.
Yeah.
The listeners that I know of that heard the Gone to the Obscure website, where this is, they this is fantastic, the Bob and Ben series. The ones who are finding it love it. And now, Ben, I don't have the echo right now. Did you do something?
I did nothing at all. I just drank a little bit of rather nice wine that I'm drinking, which is a Domaine des Essarts, a Bergerac Rouge. Bergerac is not actually a Bordeaux wine. It's right on the border of Bordeaux, but it's quite a good tip because it doesn't have the Bordeaux price, but it is very good.
Some of my listeners, or our listeners, have reported back to me what they like about you. They would love that little digression you did. So you're a big hit, Ben. And they already love me because they know me and tolerate me. And they go, well, listen to more of me. So yeah. I'm already in there, but you're doing well. Let's see. Way back there, we're talking about the frame of art. I like the way you go, very delicious.
But as soon as you say frame, I'm off on another one. I'm thinking of Frank.
Yeah, shut up, man. Okay, you've got to control yourself a bit here.
Okay.
See, remember, I'm exactly a lot like you. I can spew. If I could override you, I'd spew away as you're talking, and, you know, we have separate tracks, and you're that way. And so I say three words, you're off. You know what I mean? The words evoke you.
Well, but you get me going. But okay, I'm buttoning down my tongue.
Yeah, because I'm the same way. And you say three words to me, I'm ready to respond. I'll say this. McLuhan said the user is the content. Now, don't respond to this. I'll just say that he said in the 70s, he brought out a new aphorism. Medium as a message was known in the 60s. Then he said, well, I left out the other part. The user is the content.
That's a great dialectical addition or reply or inversion of what he's just said, and it bears thinking about. Okay, so the user is the content. Yeah,
yes.
I think that's great, yeah.
Yeah, he would say that a medium has sociological, psychological, political, educational. They run through the whole gamut of the macro institutions and the micro people and the macro people and the micro institutions. It affected everything. And he would say, if you want to assess the effects of a medium, a new environment that's come in, the user is the content or what you like about it or what you see in it and how you interpret it is only 1/10 of the totality of effects that one should try to be aware of. Make an inventory. So the user is the content is only one of the interactions with the medium. He used to say that media impose their assumptions on us and we impose our assumptions on media. So it's a dialectic interplay. But when you want to get attention, and McLuhan did believe by the Wyndham Lewis dictum, is to get attention, be outrageous, start getting noticed. The artist, somebody say, wants to get noticed. So what medium do you get noticed in? I ended up on radio. And that dictated the interruptions, the phone calls. It's ridiculous. It's not prose, all right? Now, I can write prose. And also, what I am today is not what I was yesterday. So one way to deal with me is to ignore everything I said before. It doesn't apply. Today's a new day. And you brought up the key issue, which has been thrown at me many times for 30 years, and I love to respond to that, to deal with it. So here I am cycling around trying to figure out how to do it. The next point I would make is that McLuhan said the artist that's aware of the medium traditionally seemed to be what he called a manipian satirist, like Rabelais, Alan of Lille, way back, I mean, that's 800 years ago, and then there's Menippus himself, 220 B.C., Finnegan's Wake, Jonathan Swift, which one would that be? Tale of a Tub, I think, where the writer would, like in Rabelais, just destroy the normal prose thing and put in long words and make fun of the reader, you know, sort of do a meta. That kind of art, McLuhan called Menippian satire, and he said that was what the art he liked, or no, I want to say liked. He thought that was the kind of art and how it would be presented that would show the artist is aware of the medium they're using. So he would look at someone like Cézanne, who maybe art historians say is reacting to the photograph, since he's such a historical turning point in art, at least Picasso and them said so later. Cézanne may not have been thinking of the photograph. I don't know, maybe it's written. I haven't studied him in detail. He may have said, I'm reacting to the photograph. The photograph does what I can, does better than I can do. So I'm going somewhere else. I'm going to analyze the medium of light. Now, maybe he didn't even say that. He did come up with some statements eventually. All artists have to. But he did what he did. And McLuhan would say, okay, like Wyndham Lewis said, when he was denied having his portrait shown, some of his portraits shown, I think it was in the 30s, it was a big newspaper flap about it, and he said he wasn't interested in maybe it was the Royal Conservatory, whatever the establishment museum was in. He says all the art in there is just a reaction to the photograph. Now that's a pretty interesting statement to say, and McLuhan built on that. But McLuhan is not for or against the artist. He shows how the artist is a product of a larger environment. And McLuhan considered that level of perception that he broke through into was the new art. Mm. So,
but he didn't. But he didn't forget. At least I think you're arguing this, and I was very impressed by an early essay by Marshall McLuhan that you sent to me, written in 1943, 1944, called "The New York Wits," which is an attack on the likes of James Thurber and
the New Yorker,
Dorothy Parker, the New Yorker crowd, and it's an intense attack on it. But what he's saying is that this stuff is blotting out the great artists of our time, who are Proust and Joyce, and they're not reading these people. They're blotting the really important stuff out. And in talking to you informally, not on these shows, you've said that perception carries on, and that's what I wanted to remind you of, because while dealing with this, it could sound like a skepticism about art, that you're saying, well, art's fine, but it's operating within a bigger area than most people think. People think, oh, I'm really into art, so I define myself as art, and I read limited edition poetry, and I look at marks that people make on canvases, and I go along and drink white wine at vernissage, what do you call them, private views of paintings, when all the people who buy paintings all gather together, and it's all very exciting and very chic. I'm really into art. And you're pointing out, well, McLuhan said, no, actually artists are operating in a bigger environment. Now, that could open the door to a kind of Pierre Bourdieu idea that we always look at art as kind of a ridiculous social layer of people fooling themselves, and we're above it and we can place them. We can see that they're just people performing a certain role, and that as sociologists we step above it. But in his article, The New York Wits, McLuhan isn't doing that. He's still using what he thinks is the pertinent art of his time as his point of attack. He is criticizing and mocking average artistic consumption, but he has a very strong idea of the electrifying effect of some books you might read or some pictures you might see, the great art of our time, the really important stuff, which allows you to see everything. You know, that he's an absolute proselytizer and enthusiast for art, but in a very critical way. I mean, you know, for a very specific few people who've done something, that what they've done really matters. And you've said to me that you think that carries on throughout McLuhan, that he doesn't lose that.
Yeah. He writes that article right after he meets Lewis in 43 in Detroit, and then takes Lewis down to St. Louis, Missouri, I guess it is, and gets him commissions, including he gets the founder of Monsanto, you know, the big boogeyman for genetic modification of plants, that cartel, the originator of it, had his portrait done by Lewis, because McLuhan knew him somehow, and so he got commissions for Lewis. So they spent a year or so together, and very closely, and he quickly, having read Lewis at Cambridge in the mid-30s, and I guess continuing to read him, but Medium really sparked him. So within a year, in 44, he produces several articles, Edgar Poe's Tradition, the New York, and one on Wyndham Lewis called Lemuel and Lilliput. And he's totally a Lewisian guy. And so you'll see the New Yorker, what does he do? He says, this is just Bloomsbury transplanted over to New York, and he adopts a Lewisian perspective on it. Would you agree?
Yes. But held in the Lewisian perspective is an idea of the crucial role of real art. That it's totally in favour of the real art versus the phonies. It's angry, it's fierce, it's critical. It's like a proper critic. It's like, I have specified what is the really good art, and it burns up all this mediocre crap that's around it, like wood shavings. You know, it's the spark. This is the stuff that really matters. I just wanted to remind you of that, because in the way that you're explaining McLuhan before, it could almost sound like he's saying, well, art is only a little area of people marking canvases, and they don't understand this TV, and, you know, so the artists are somehow out of touch and, you know, a bit of a sideline. And he's doing both those things, actually, isn't he? He's explaining how great some, you know, but
you gotta stop.
Yeah,
let
sorry, yeah, 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 go on.
He considered that artists, the great artists or the significant artists, were the most important cultural producers around, because they gave inklings and pointers to what was going on. He did not deny the role of art. But what was interesting is that once television came in the 50s and 60s, and art became commodified or became content on television, he knew the agenda of celebrating art. And I've sent you this quote, I think, a few times from a book he wrote in 1960, where he talked about the obsolescence of the traditional great role of the art under computer, TV, satellite conditions. The artist agenda had to change. And so he And okay, so then I want to just say that, and then go back. I mean, you're right to see that he values art, but that's in the 40s. It's a different world by the 60s.
But even in the 60s, I think he's still arguing the same thing. He's arguing
Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake. He drops Lewis in the early 60s. He knows that the mixed corporate media synesthetic collage, the Pomo collage of the global theater effect, that Lewis's in English prose, though great it was, is not going to get attention with the baby boomers who are on taking drugs and having synesthesia environmental effects. He knew that the closest book to that, the best mind fuck, so to speak, is Finnegan's Wake. You know what I mean? He said, well, this keeps up with them.
I love hearing you telling me more about McLuhan and what McLuhan said, but I want to get closer to the truth, which we could work out between us, naked, without clothing us in McLuhan. Yeah.
And can I respond to that?
Let me respond. Go on.
One time in a seminar, someone said that to McLuhan. They said, that's just a half truth what you said. We want the whole truth. We want more. And he says, well, a half truth is a lot of truth for most people.
That's a good line. But I do want to get back to the particular.
But that relates to when I go, Finnegan's Wake has no content, or the user's content, meaning it's met. Those are half truths. Mm. And we purposely leave out the other half. Mm. We'll bring that in later. That's a technique of Manipian conversation in this Manipian. He considered the electric environment as Manipian environment. So you couldn't be a Manipian satirist in the traditional way. He actually started claiming he was a scientist. The heck with art. So these are all glimmers I'm giving you.
Yeah, well, as soon as you're defined as this... or that, I mean, one has an objection. I mean, having been a music journalist for 20 years, I had to get used to the fact that musicians are always saying, I hate labels, you know, which is sort of the most boring thing that anyone can say, because it means they don't really want to talk to you, because labels, i.e. concepts, are the only things actually you've got to throw around, you know, with somebody else. So when they start off with that kind of like, well, I don't like labels, but I do understand why people refuse to be categorized, because it puts them on a shelf, mark A or B, and you're actually aspiring to be universal, and you don't want to be placed over in this area called jazz, or, you know, whatever it is that you're being placed in, that you want to be able to be free to respond to everything and to criticize everything and aspire to be universal, and so you don't like these petty places that you're being stuck into, and that's fairly general, is a resistance to that. I mean, most people sympathize with that, even though everybody spends their whole time doing it to each other.
Well, this is where McLuhan's techniques are important and relevant. It's the line from Sweeney Agonistes, Eliot's incomplete poem, where the character, one character says, I got to use words when I talk to you. You could say to the musician who doesn't want to be categorized, yes, but we're using words. We're not playing instruments back at each other. Oh. We are talking. And if I was you, Ben, I would say to them, yes, as a musician, you don't want to be classified, but why react to the subset activity of talking? You're specializing in being a universalist or generalist or uncategorizable. This is what I'm saying you should say to them. And that you should be able to drop that and actually engage with language, because you're talking to someone, Ben Watson, who understands the limitation of that medium. So we can playfully engage it, but it's not casting something in stone. And usually if you do that to a musician, they'll go, oh, whatever. That's too complex. And then
unless they're German, in which case they will take you up and you'll have a good discussion about philosophy and aesthetics. But otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting, I assume in the 19th century, artists wanted to be categorized. That's what the manifestos were about. I mean, I'm a surrealist. I'm a dadaist. I'm this. I'm that. And that's back in simpler times in terms of media environments. When you get into the 60s, 70s, 80s now, with so many media environments, people instinctively, the average grades, someone who has no literate education instinctively knows that I shouldn't be categorized. I got to be so many different kinds of people today with different environments constantly that it's an intuitive thing that, hey, don't categorize me. That's not relevant to the rhythms of our life every day. So there's that reason why that the attitude has changed and people don't want to be categorized. And so that, so I could go on, but I'll let you respond.
Well, it makes me think that an interesting perverse response to this thing, since everybody is running away from being categorized and everybody's become a flexible postmodern you know, kind of hip person who can swap this and swap that, that it becomes really interesting to posit the opposite as a kind of provocative pole around which to attract people.
Definitely what McLuhan did. He knew that this was the most, the 20th century was the greatest creative outpouring in so many different landscapes. And so since that was the norm, there was so much creativity going on every day in all the media, he said, well, how will I be the anti-environment to that? I will not be creative. I will explain the steps of the creative process. I will repeat myself and appear bland and repetitive. And that's why when he started get famous and put out a couple of books, everybody thought it was great. But then the later books, they said, this is the same old crap. This is, the guy doesn't produce anything new. It's the same book, just different audience targeted. He did that on purpose because he didn't, in a way, he was trying to be anti-environmental. And that was only as a private citizen writing puny books. If he was really given the opportunity, he would have taken over the United Nations, would have had a three-week fast of television, shut it all down all over the world, and he said that would have been the real musical composition. That would be affecting the big note.
Well, this is getting back, and John Cage is relevant to what I'm going to say, because you've once I'd sort of got over my kind of wave of irritation that went back to you expounding McLuhan again, when you got through to the television environment in which people actually are, and realizing that, well, this is quite a personal thing to say, but that my personal revolt has been against arts which don't articulate what my experience has been, but are some kind of artistic realm which I can go into and be part of, but which are an alternative to my actual experience. So for me, if something doesn't explain to me why Daleks were frightening and why the Doctor Who theme is fantastic, then this art doesn't matter. I mean, it's not talking to me. It's or me or all the people I was brought up with or my generation or anything that really speaks and works as my my social glue. And it's a social glue to me that needs to be addressed. And I'm not interested in art which is a haven away from the social glue, which is not to say that therefore I love the social glue. In fact, most of what I like is stuff which knows how stinky the social glue is, but realizes that we're all in it up to our necks and we can all talk about this evil stuff just about to drown us.
Yeah, the slime coming out of the TV set. So I think, were you saying 2 minutes back that you think that these POMO artists, you want them to be able to explain what they're doing? Is that what you were saying?
Well, I'm very skeptical about artists who are too fluid with concepts, and art which seems to be produced by fluency with concepts, that when people have learnt the new ways of talking and then they go and do some art which fulfills various famous critics of call for this and call for that, all that is always lukewarm and tedious and you don't want to go near it. And the art I like often comes from people who are extremely inept at expressing or justifying what they do. They happen to go along and do it. But at the same time, what interests me is a discussion with those people, which throws me back on having to honestly express in a clear way what I actually think and have a real discussion in which I don't have an environment which is easy for me, in which people will applaud what I've read, that I have to project what I'm saying rawly into people's mixed up versions of this and that, and the kind of confetti of stuff that is the common language. And that's when I'm tested, when I get excited. And that's what I think a real critic should do. They shouldn't bask within terms in which everyone is talking the same language. They should respond to something that turns them on and pursue those people and get into discussions with them, even if it hurts, you know, even if it's hard. And that's where things, to me, get interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I want to add this. What comes to mind is one night in the McLuhan seminar, a poet came in, not a major poet, but, you know, middle level, and he wanted to read his poem. He wanted the seminar in McLuhan to hear it. So he does his poem. He rants on for about 4 minutes. Then he looks at McLuhan waiting for the response. McLuhan says, way too many words. Way, way too many words. He says, your poem should only be 12 words, he said. This guy had gone on and spewed about 2,000 words. It was not what he expected, but do you find any resonance with that response by McLuhan?
Well, I mean, I like the idea of someone who's going to both invite someone in to do their stuff and then disagree with them. I mean, I think that's great. I mean, I like people like that, you know, that are open and critical. And the problem always seems to be that the people who are open end up doing this secret thing, which is patronizing, by just saying everything's great, and you don't disagree with what people do, and so you're open, or you're closed, and you never listen to those people. But it sounds great to invite somebody in and then actually ask them to respond to what you think, which in some areas is considered to be insulting or rude or difficult or obnoxious, you know. But it seems to me is real communication.
That's right, and McLuhan did what you like. He would always have a guest, and there'd be everybody from Trudeau to some news broadcaster. All kinds of level society would come, you know, each one Monday night to be a guest. And the secret among the insiders, which I was inside and aware of, was that the guests would come and say, oh, gee, I got to present this in this lofty seminar situation, and they might be nervous, and they prepare their paper, because they were the guest of honor. They didn't know that we on the inside called them the jest of honor. They would start to talk. They would have something presenting for maybe 15 minutes. Maybe McLuhan told them, present something 10 or 15 minutes. They get about 3 minutes into it, and then McLuhan and everybody would pile on him. They'd immediately undercut, abort, cancel. The guy would be forgotten. And that was the what he called trickster element of McLuhan. And it would make the person become, they were presenting a product. McLuhan wasn't interested in product. He wanted to engage in the present and what we can know now. So he would have to always dupe.
Now, Bob, all this sounds really lovely, and I wish I'd been involved with these beautiful seminars that happened in the 60s that you're still telling everybody about. But how do we make anything as wonderful as that happen now? Because in England, in England at the moment, the only equivalent to Marshall McLuhan must be Slavoj Žižek. He's our only one. He's the only one who's famous, slightly. I don't know if you've heard of him. Have you heard of him?
I know him.
Yeah.
I've met him and I've seen him perform several times in New York City.
And, you know, I fend off review CDs from all comers, and I get one from Gwili Edmondes, who's a great guy, but I've never liked his music, and he's got Slavoj Žižek on the cover, you know, and so he's a hip reference point for a lot of people. And I'm talking in the nursery where I take my children, and there's Yuri there, who's from, I may get this wrong, I think it's Romania, but it may be another one of those countries out there. And you're right, we're talking and mentioned something, and I said, well, you know, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist, really. And he goes, oh, yeah, there was an idea of communism conference with Slavoj Žižek, you know. So these celebrities you might object to from a purist perspective can't quite be ignored, because they're there and they're part of the language confetti that everybody's chucking around, so you have to take positions within it and accept that that's part of the deal, you know, when you're talking to people. So there's Zizek. So he's okay, the only, he's the only one I can think of who might be like McLuhan, isn't he?
What? No, he's not like McLuhan. And so McLuhan had to deal with that, the beginning phenomenon of how to be an anti-environment in a situation where everybody was an anti-environment and it was all canceling out. So you know how he got rid of Zizek or whatever you don't like? He said, turn off the whole environment. That is how you do a trickster act. You could. We now had access to whole media environments. You following this, what I'm saying?
Well, but how do you turn off the whole environment and keep your intelligence and your sense of social awareness and your idea that you're actually doing something? I mean, turn off your whole media environment. It sounds like a mystical idea of I'll sit on a lotus, you know?
No, no, no.
But how good
no.
is that?
No, no, not personally.
I mean, I want something funnier, now, more critical, more extreme, more amusing to me, more Frank Zappa-like. You know, I don't want to sit on a lotus. I don't want to just turn it all off.
Ben, you're going off about the lotus, and that's not... You did not understand me. You have to try to understand what I'm saying, and maybe it means you have to shut up a little longer so I can say it. He meant by turning off the environment, not you. He meant that the Prime Minister must mandate for all of Canada a three-week television fast. That is the only relevant political program.
Yeah, well, that was a great argument. I mean, there's a great demand.
Not because he didn't like TV. It's just we had to become of what the television was doing to previous environments and everybody in the present. And the only way to do it and become aware of it is to alter our perceptions by turning it off. We have a non-TV environment. Mm-hmm. Then we see how we feel and the reactions, and there'll be lots of radio discussions about how I'm feeling. Yeah. Many people going cold turkey, and then turn it back on. Mm. But we're a little more aware. That, in other words, he realized people making art for galleries or for lectures or Zizek just keeping the publishing industry going was so puny, tiny. He had no respect for any cultural content in relation to the real issue, which was the greater art masterpiece was television itself. Not because it's good, but because it had changed reality. And so he began by saying, you know, yeah. There were professors in the States who were outraged when McLuhan would come, and he would not get out with their students and protest the draft. McLuhan said, you guys want to live in this little place called the United States? Do you realize where you are? You're just kind of disembodied around the whole planet, and the only way to get out of that situation is turn off television. The Vietnam War is a necessary reflex subset for American culture in the global theater. And they hated him for saying that. But Ben, he was doing what you like. He was pulling the rug out of everybody.
Well, I don't know. It sounds Baudrillardian to me.
Baudrillard replayed that.
Yeah. You're all in a television environment, and the really profound thing is not to protest Vietnam because you're caught in a media conspiracy to make you think about this other thing.
Yes.
I find that it's getting too wildly out of touch with actualities to me. You know, I mean, there is a wall through Jerusalem. There are bombs raining on people. You know, these things are not simply reflexes of media. What was it, Baudrillard's idea, you know, the Gulf War never happened, you know? Well, it did, you know? I think the media...
Trying to be
Well, I mean, the bit I dislike about how you're explaining McLuhan now is an idea that...
You threw the changes, Ben. One way you like it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'm working this out from my Marxist perspective. But from my Marxist perspective... I think that the media is not all-powerful. It is not creating the reality we're in. It is that the reality we're in is gunships and power and people working, creating surplus value, and other people finding ways of dealing with that surplus value. That's the reality, and the media is a kind of version of that which gets thrown around and it has relations to it. But the idea that it's determining and it's the all important thing is to me a kind of artistic madness, which is exciting to go into, and a certain thing in which, in certain insane states, I've entered into. And I think entering into those insane states is interesting and crucial, like dreams. But I'm still gonna hold back from saying that the dream is the reality. You know, I think it's important to analyze dreams. It's important to analyze media. It's crucial to analyze media. But I'm analyzing something which I don't believe is determining everything. What's determining everything is capital, the accumulation of capital. That's the situation we're in, and that's why it's so bad. Okay. That's really the thing that's governing us. That's the thing we need to break. So this media obsession and the idea that it's creating everything is a topsy-turvical illusion. And if you read the early part of Capital,
Let me be more elaborate. I got you. Let me respond to this.
Okay.
First of all, remember McLuhan said a half-truth is a lot of truth. McLuhan was accused, when he became famous, of being a technological determinist, making too much out of media. Now, if we knew that McLuhan knew that it was a half-truth, he didn't mind inflating a half-truth that the medium was the message as an anti-environment to those all lost in the content, or at least another perspective on a changing situation. And that's why he said, I meant the other half-truth, the user is the content. You know, I meant that, but I didn't say it, but I'll say it in the 70s. On top of that, what does he say in the Woody Allen movie? And he said to many graduations, convocations, when he was heckled, he said, oh, you think my whole fallacy is wrong. He admitted it was a fallacy. But you have to understand why he was presenting a fallacy as science. And then the more you understood what he was saying, you saw the context he was presenting it in. He would agree with everything you said privately. Here's a guy that everybody said was anti-book, saying the book was obsolete. And when they actually talked to him personally in a private context, and he did say it in Playboy interview, which was like a private interview, he says, the idea are that I'm against books is absurd. I spend my life 24/7 teaching literature. Books are my sacred reality. I am a professor, a 19th century professor. And so there was a different McLuhan when you met him privately than when you saw in the media. And the guy in the media was a manipian satirist, and he found out a way to get attention in the Lewisian vortices mode and then present something that was new to people.
But I think the manipian satire or the... that's how you make this little baseball figure work. You press the knob on his head. I never realized, I've had it for 3 years. I never realized that. Sorry about that. And I feel the same sense of solution, actually. I've found this little knob on this toy, and I found the knob on the toy that is Bob Dobbs, because the McLuhanite satire as a media, you see, I think that satire has become completely fluent with CNN. I think CNN is Baudrillardian.
McLuhan would agree there'd be a different McLuhan.
That it's been absorbed. That knowledge has been absorbed. I think all the people, all these assholes in their pressed skirts and their pressed suits and their specially fixed teeth, talking to me on CNN, have all absorbed all that McLuhanite, Baudrillardian sophistication about media and spin. And therefore,
everybody got what he was saying and he took a new tack.
And so the revolution we're talking about is the direct statement of talking about value and what generates value, that fundamental Marxism is suddenly the only thing that sticks in the craw of this beast called media. And that positing the true relations of exploitation that exists when people work under capitalism, that this kind of basic stuff, and I'm talking way more basic than any kind of communist ideal, I'm talking about the way money actually works, becomes the subversive, important, exciting, difficult thing to do.
I agree. We're still trying to get to the first show where we talk about the present.
We're working towards the present. We're always doing that.
We're trying to get to the present. And you did bring up, well, what are we going to do now, Bob? now, what are we doing now in the show? How do we get attention, or how do we get whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
Let me bring up John Cage, just one last reference to the past. And then
okay, this is we've reached the climax with my expression of absolute fundamental Marxist idea that understanding value and exploitation and money is the crucial thing. And so now we're going to have a little coda where we relax the listener back into whatever they want to do in their everyday life, because we've got at least 6 minutes left, and we'll just chat a little bit about John Cage.
Yeah, no, I just want to explain that your objection, that's what I liked about our class in cleavage. What you object to, I object to too. And the whole pomoism that took over, which is the McLuhan light, McLuhan predicted, he knew he was so correct that he would become a successful meme, and then it would be inappropriate and he would need a new anti-environment. It took me to provide the anti-environment starting in the middle 80s.
Okay, you, Bob Dobbs, the anti-environment and the McLuhanism that everybody now subscribes to.
Yes.
You're the retrovirus to the McLuhanite ideology.
Exactly. And so that's why the words you write, I can agree with, because you're peeved at the McLuhan meme and its effects, known as pomoism, has taken over. And that's a big somnambulism. And we need to, how are we going to wake these people up? Mm. And do they need awakening? What do we do while they remain awake, in quotes? So when McLuhan quoted John Cage, he's not promoting John Cage. He's showing John Cage as a dupe of the present media determinism. That's how he used everybody. So that's the yes, John Cage.
But is that Bob? Is that your gloss? Because to be hostile to John Cage is it's a tricky thing to do, because you throw yourself in the wrong camp. I mean, I've often celebrated and defended John Cage, you know, to the wrong people. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, the idea of creating a space in a classical concert where something interesting might happen that nobody expects, you know, is thoroughly good. And there are all sorts of ways in which I'm very keen on John Cage's effect within the classical music sphere. But philosophically and politically and educationally, the way Cage has been absorbed, I'm really against. But that's something else. So
No, that's the issue. Cage was absorbed. There were larger environmental issues that would make Cage obsolete. And McLuhan was pointing out and warning, what will make Cage obsolete? He saw that everybody would become Cage-like, Cageian. And he saw the trends that were happening in the 60s would become dominant.
Bob, so tell me how you feel about John Cage's use of Finnegan's Wake. Are you aware of that?
Of course, I know John Cage, spent time with him. I'll just tell you what I said. I asked John Cage, what do you think of McLuhan? He said, well, McLuhan's a detective. And that was a very intelligent response to the question, what is McLuhan? He was right. McLuhan was a detective. He had himself photographed as Sherlock Holmes. But anyways, in Sherlock Holmes costume. But the thing about Cage is success leads to somnambulism. Cage was good for a few minutes in 1961. And Frank came along, absorbed Cage, appreciated, and it meant past Cage and created greater art than Cage. And Frank didn't need to know Finnegan's Wake. John Cage was an aesthete. He liked Finnegan's Wake as an aesthetic artifact. And he did not have a clue what it was, the way McLuhan
he had no clue as to its content. You nearly said
That's right.
Because when, you see, I object to John Cage's use of Finnegan's Wake because he turned it into what he called mesostics. What he does, he took the words and he rearranged them and then he recited them, and it was like a game with these counters, and he never got to the actual power, the surging power of the music of those paragraphs that have been written. And if you read them out, they are music, man. They are like, they break on you. They're huge. Anyone can mouth them. You don't need to know any language at all. You can try and mouth those words in Finnegan's Wake, and it will make your mouth do things that you've never even imagined. And he didn't deal with that. He chopped it all up and said Finnegan's Wake is kind of a random, postmodern, effete sort of airy-fairy thing. And that makes me cross.
Ben, not only did he do that, When he did Roratoria, it was based on McLuhan's analysis of the Ten Thunders. He knew McLuhan was the best guide to the wake, and yet he totally misunderstood McLuhan and produced the very grievance that you're expressing, and I agree with that grievance. He was a failure in presenting Finnegan's Wake. And the irony is that he used McLuhan as a guide, but he had no clue what McLuhan was about, and McLuhan knew that.
It's hilarious, Bob, and I'm so glad that we can leave the number 8 program of Bob and Ben discuss Marx and McLuhan over the over of Frank Zappa on that note. Thanks very much, Bob. It's been great talking to you, and I thought that was just an amazing finish to the show. Just congratulations, Mr. Bob Dobbs.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.